from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about AIDS. And if you take a look at look around the world and look at the numbers of people who are infected with HIV and where they live, it becomes evident very quickly that Africa has become disproportionately affected. In fact, here, for example, in 2005, roughly 40% of all of those people infected with HIV lived in just 11 countries in East and Southern Africa. And this was a place that's home to less than 3% of the world's population. So here is the question. Why is it that the epidemic in East and Southern Africa is so severe? And why has it been so difficult to control? Those are the questions we'll be taking up this morning in this part of the show, with our guest, Helen Epstein. She writes frequently on public health for many publications, including the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Magazine, and she's the author of a book that's titled The Invisible Cure. The subtitle is Africa, the West, and the Fight Against AIDS. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And in this book, she makes the argument that for a long time now, scientists have misunderstood the nature of AIDS in Africa, and as a result, public health programs that have been designed to try to limit the spread of the infection have really been much less effective than they might have been. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number if you're here where we are. But if you're listening over the air around Illinois or Indiana, or you're listening on the internet in the United States, you may use our toll-free line and we'll pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL or 9455. Again, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Ms. Epstein, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Not too bad.
Good. Well, I appreciate you giving us time. Just as a way of reviewing, can you just talk for a moment about what it is we know now about the numbers of people around the world infected with HIV, and where has the disease been most severe?
According to the most recent UN AIDS report, there are about 33 million people in the world living with HIV or AIDS, the vast majority of them, about 63% of them, live in sub-Saharan Africa, and most of those live in a kind of arc of territory along the southern and eastern rim of the continent, from Uganda, including countries like from Uganda and Kenya, Tanzania, down through southern Africa, South Africa, Botswana, Swaziland, Lesotho, Mozambique, and so on. As you mentioned in your introduction, this is home to nearly half of those living with HIV in the world, this whole region.
Why? So let me just go right to the big question that, you know, given indeed the fact that this is such a small percentage of the world's population, and at the same time, though the disease is concentrated at such high levels here, one indeed has to ask the question, why here?
Yeah. Well, the reasons are complex and have been much debated over the years, but there's a growing consensus that there are two factors which stand out as being particularly important. One of them is, just to make clear at the outset, it seems as though a large number of surveys of sexual behavior conducted over the past 20 years in this region have not found that African people have more sexual partners on average than people in other world regions do. In fact, studies I've seen suggest they have, on average, over a lifetime, slightly fewer sexual partners than Americans do, for example, both men and women. But what does seem to happen there with greater frequency is that both men and women are more likely to have more than one long-term partner at a time. And these partnerships may overlap from, for months or years even. For example, a man may have two wives. Polygamy is quite common in much of the region. Or he may have a wife and a girlfriend and sleep regularly with both of them. And one of those women may have another regular partner, and that partner may have another partner or perhaps two other partners, and one of those partners may have another partner, and so on and so forth. And this kind of gives rise, if you can imagine it, to a kind of super highway system for the HIV virus that allows it to spread very, very rapidly to large numbers of people. There's a growing consensus that this contributes significantly to the higher rates of HIV in that region. Another factor is the lack of male circumcision. It turns out that recent studies have shown that circumcised men are about 60 to 70% less likely to be infected with HIV. So in parts of Africa and other world regions where circumcision is very common, you tend to see much lower rates of HIV infection, mm-hmm. especially, for example, West Africa. That probably explains why HIV rates are much lower there.
You know, it's very interesting, particularly this first point that you raise, because this seems to run counter to what I expect in many people's minds would be the prevailing sort of perception about what kind of behavior pattern facilitates the spread. And the idea is that it's a lot of sexual contact with a lot of different people. And it could be just a brief sexual contact. But the idea is, and I think in Africa, probably the image that has been promoted, it's the truck drivers and the prostitutes. You know, the idea that what spreads this is people who are promiscuous maybe a small number of times, but with a large number of partners. And this is a different sort of picture entirely, and you can understand why, if your policy is aimed at one kind of sort of model of behavior and spread, and if people can't relate to that model, if they say, well, that's not what I'm doing, and if your efforts to try to change people's behavior and limit the spread is aimed at one kind of model, if in fact what people are really doing is very different, then the whole thing sort of breaks down because your prevention doesn't get at what the real issue is, and people are saying, well, I don't live in that way, so then obviously I don't have a problem, or I'm not at risk, or I don't really have to do anything different. And that seems to be both those things seem to be key factors here when you ask this question. Well, why is it that the efforts at limiting the spread of the disease, in fact, haven't been more effective in this particular place?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not that. I mean, there are commercial sex workers or prostitutes in many African towns and cities, and there are certainly migrant itinerant men who go to them. But in fact, the number of commercial sex workers or prostitutes and the tendency of men to visit sexual prostitutes is actually men in Africa are much less likely to do that than men in Asia are. In Thailand, for example, surveys in the early 90s suggested that roughly half of men in Bangkok visited commercial sex workers on a fairly regular basis, maybe five times a year. But that kind of behavior is much, much rarer in Africa, it turns out. But even so, in Thailand, the HIV rate never exceeded 1 or 2% of the total population, whereas in these African countries, in South Africa, for example, the roughly a quarter of all in some regions are HIV positive of all adults. So I think you're right. I think the problem has been that for a long time there was this assumption that the African epidemic was caused by high levels of prostitution, and so the prevention campaigns tended naturally to target that and to address so-called high-risk behavior. But a growing number of studies began to show that a lot of people assumed to be low risk, ordinary, you know, kind of faithful wives of men who were not particularly promiscuous and didn't go to prostitutes and so on, were at just as high risk as commercial sex workers were. And this was a kind of lingering puzzle for a long time. And until this new theory began to kind of gain traction in the last few years. And I think it's clarified a lot of things. The problem is that for too long, I think many African people didn't realize the risks they themselves were facing, and that their greatest risks were coming not from promiscuous others and sex workers and rootless migrant men, but from the people they knew best and the people they were closest to. It gave them a kind of false sense of security, I think.
Given the fact that it is a sexually transmitted disease, you would think that in trying to understand how the disease spread, you would want to get the best understanding that you could of people's sexual behavior. Now that's not necessarily easy, because talking to people about their sexual behavior is not an easy thing for anybody, either the interviewer or the interviewee. But having said that, it seems a little surprising that perhaps it took so long for researchers to realize to put these two things together, to look at the way they had been thinking about it and to look at the way people really were behaving, and then to realize that, in fact, people's real behavior was something different than what they were thinking. And again, then your approach to trying to limit the spread would have to be different, because you're looking at a different kind of pattern of sexual relations.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it was a sort of, I think the unfortunate failure of so many attempts to limit the spread of HIV in East and Southern Africa led people and experts and so on to re-examine their hypotheses and their theories and their approaches as well, most importantly. And that essentially it really did seem to make sense to everyone, including me, for years, that actually addressing these so-called high-risk groups, the prostitutes, the truck drivers, and so on, was going to have a major impact. And it wasn't until, I don't know, about beginning about 10 years ago, but then really into the sort of early 2000s, that it began to dawn on people that this approach just wasn't working as well as people expected it to, and that something else was going on. And it was just bad luck that they didn't see it either earlier. The other problem is, as you say, it is extremely hard to measure sexual behavior, and because people, especially women, and especially young women, who tend to be at very high risk of HIV, aren't always open about it with interviewers. But there are new techniques that people are working out that can bring out much more honest answers, I think, and that are shedding light on the enormous complexity of sexual behavior, not just in this region, but within the region from place to place and all over the world. Mm-hmm. It's quite a fascinating subject, actually.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Helen Epstein. She is a writer. She writes on public health and has written for various publications, including the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Magazine. She's the author of the book, The Invisible Cure. The subtitle is Africa, the West, and the Fight Against AIDS. Farrar Strauss-Giroux is the publisher of the book. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. If you wouldn't mind just talking about your background for a moment, I understand that you had a background in molecular biology, and that you got involved in perhaps thinking about AIDS, at least, or working on the issue, because you were involved in a project to try to develop a vaccine.
Yeah, back in 1993, I went out to Uganda to do some preliminary research on an AIDS vaccine for a biotech company in California. And at the time, there was, I guess in about half of the HIV virus was discovered in 1980, four, so it was hoped, it was assumed that a vaccine would be available within a few years, but we still don't have one. And when I was working on a vaccine, vaccines back in 1993 and 1994, there was still some sort of fading hope that it might be easy to make such a vaccine. But you know, my own small contributions and those of many, many others have proven how difficult that is. And so I guess since then, I've been trying to think about what else might be done to control the epidemic.
Mm. Well, just on that point for a moment more, and then I have a caller we'll get to, do you think that at some point, and I suppose that gives us a lot of room if I just say it like that, at some point there will be a vaccine?
Well, that's an open question. I would not want to say there never will be a vaccine, but I think most experts who follow this subject very closely would agree that there won't be one in the next decade. And we need to think of something to do urgently before then.
Mm-hmm. Well, then is the then I suppose the thing that we do have to turn to, given the fact that we have a pretty good idea how the viruses have quite a good idea how the viruses spread, that then we the only thing it sounds as if the really the only thing that we can fall back on is trying to talk with people about their behavior, what they do, and then get them to change that. So we attack it that way rather than the other way.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the moment it's the only weapon we have. It's a tricky one. I mean, nobody likes talking about sexual behavior, and nobody likes changing it, for that matter. But we have to, it's a matter of life and death. And with 20 million people dead of this disease, I think we better start talking about it.
Mm-hmm. I think that probably, generally speaking, what we have focused on with the issue all around the world, really, is to try to indeed make sure people know how this disease is transmitted, and then to essentially to say to them, look, the way that you can reduce your chances is to reduce your number of sexual partners, and we encourage people to not have, you know, if you can do that, not have sex until you get married, or limit your number of partners otherwise. If you're married or in a committed relationship, make that your only relationship. And then one of the bottom line things, as we say, is, you know, no matter what, use a barrier method of contraception, use a condom, because that will go some way to try to limit the spread. Now, we've also, people in Africa, for example, have made that same kind of program. That's what they've tried to tell people. Basically, abstinence as much as that's possible, faithfulness within your committed relationship, and then using condoms. And the thing is that the results simply from that have been kind of disappointing. Why is it that somehow that just doesn't, is not sufficient?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that the sort of ABC message, abstain, be faithful, use a condom, makes sense. I mean, it's sort of obvious. But on the other hand, it still implies, I think the most difficult thing to convey, and the most important thing to convey in this part of the world, is that HIV is really everyone's problem. In some of these countries, 25% of adults, that's a quarter of all adults, one in four, is HIV positive. Essentially, everyone from kind of, you know, the women who sell tomatoes on the street to cabinet ministers are at risk of this disease. Everyone is, regardless of, you know, whether they have large numbers of sexual partners or only one. And so, essentially, these messages of, you know, abstain until marriage and be faithful to one partner thereafter kind of imply that the people who are at risk of AIDS are those immoral people who misbehave and whose behavior isn't normative or ordinary. And that if you just behave yourself and act in a moral way, then you won't get the virus. When, in fact, a lot of people who consider themselves faithful, if not to one person, then maybe to, you know, two trusted long-term partners and so on, are at extremely high risk of this disease. And that So in other words, the problem with the abstinence message is that it kind of divides people into these categories of high risk and low risk, when in this part of the world, everyone's at risk, and the virus, the disease needs to be looked at in a completely sort of different way. And ditto the condom message. I mean, condoms everywhere are, especially in this part of the world, are associated with high risk, immoral behavior. And people who use condoms are considered, you know, loose and irresponsible sexually and so on. And it's very hard to break down that stigma. They're also awkward. They interfere with intimacy and so on. And so people don't like to use them with their long-term partners. But those long-term partners are exactly the ones who they're most likely to get infected by. So this creates a real dilemma. And what the solution, as far as I can tell, is that people really just need to get together, take on this new information that the virus is spreading through longer-term relationships, not through high-level, well, as well as through lots of, you know, sort of the promiscuous behavior of a relatively small number of people, but mainly through long-term relationships, and discuss this. Speak openly about it. Talk about it with their friends, their partners, their children, and really try to figure out what to do and make a collective shift in their sexual norms. And that's possible. It sounds really complicated, but this is what happened in the gay community in the United States. There was a radical shift in sexual norms in the 1980s, which saved, you know, perhaps a million lives. And the same thing happened in Uganda in the 1980s and early 1990s, when there was a kind of people there, for whatever reason, had a kind of implicit understanding of these concurrent sexual networks. They didn't use the word concurrency, but they understood what it was all about, and that ordinary people in relatively ordinary relationships were at just as high risk as commercial sex workers and prostitutes and truck drivers and so on. So they all got together and they talked about it, and they mounted campaigns, and they the government launched a campaign called Zero Grazing, which was kind of vernacular slogan, meaning stay within the confines of your own sort of family sexual situation, and don't go out with bar girls, and don't have casual sex, and don't seduce new concurrent partners and so on. It was really, a lot of it was addressed at men, but women as well. So, I mean, I think it takes a kind of mass collective conversation, and that hasn't happened yet in a lot of southern African countries in particular, where HIV is spreading most rapidly. And one hopes that this new awareness of this new science suggesting how the virus is spreading will generate that kind of debate.
Well, I want to, the caller here has been patient. I want to bring in our caller here in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, what's absent right now from this conversation when you're talking about abstinence is you're not pointing out that the U.S. still has this policy that, I forget what the percentage is, but a certain fixed percentage of America's AIDS outreach budget is dedicated to teaching of abstinence, which has been documented, and you probably have the study in front of you, or could pull it up real quick, shows that it isn't effective. It's a waste of money. That's part of the U.S. role, but if we go back a few years, another part of the U.S. role, and this doesn't have to do with the spread, but it has to do with the treatment, is that there was, I forget exactly what year, I think it was the end of Bush's first term, there was a consensus worldwide about how to get generic drugs into Africa, and it was established, it was going to be gone ahead at, and at the last minute, Dick Cheney personally goes and throws the table up in the air and says, we don't agree with this anymore. And it was clearly a complete response to Big Pharma. I know things have happened subsequently, but I still think that there's still too much money, too much overhead in the treatment of Africa. It's still seen as a cash-making opportunity, it seems to me. And I know that's a little bit of a digression from teaching people to the roles, but it seems to me when people feel so helpless that that aspect of it, they don't feel there is a treatment. They can just kind of react in sort of a relatively what we would say is a nihilist way. I mean, trusting to fate or something. Mm. When there is a way of dealing with it, they might have a you know, this is a calculation that I don't think, and I'm not sure that it's the case. I'd like your reflection on all of those, and yeah. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thanks for your question. Yeah, and your views. I mean, I think one thing to bear in mind is that the dramatic declines in HIV infection rates that occurred in the gay community, and in Uganda, and in Thailand, and in many other countries, occurred in the absence of HIV treatment. So, in other words, it is very much possible to reduce HIV infection rates even when people have no access to treatment. So treatment's absolutely important as a humanitarian emergency, essentially. But as far as preventing new infections, it's not clear that it plays an important role, or certainly not a necessary role, I guess. Regarding the U.S. government and its policies, it is true that the government has put hundreds of millions of dollars, unfortunately, into programs that are based on abstinence-only curricula that were developed really in the United States back since the 1980s, and are also supported in U.S. schools by the government as well. And study after study after study has shown that these programs are not effective in preventing either pregnancy or STDs, including HIV. And so it was extremely disappointing that the U.S. government was becoming involved in promoting these kinds of programs overseas. However, it's important to bear in mind that these are not the only programs the U.S. government is supporting. The government spends, I think, about $1 billion or so on HIV prevention. And much of that money does not go to abstinence-only education. It actually goes to programs that I think all of us, much of it also goes to programs that I think all of us would support to kind of improve dialogue between men and women, to promote information about HIV in kind of non-moralistic terms to large numbers of people. And so it's a kind of mixed bag, actually. And, much of what the U.S. government is doing is highly dubious. Much of it is actually not too bad as well. So it's a complicated story. And in terms of the access to generic drugs, that's another terribly important question that you raise. And I think that the people who should really be complaining about it are U.S. citizens who, by and large, I mean, support overwhelmingly the promotion of AIDS treatment for African people, and we all want to see as many people brought into these programs as possible. And the U.S. government has probably been responsible for, you know, at least 1 million Africans being brought onto treatment, HIV treatment, and had their lives extended by it. But it's possible we could have treated even more if the U.S. had been quicker to use much cheaper drug formulations produced by generic drug companies.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here, and I have another call I want to get to in just a moment, but I also, for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in here in the last 10 or 15 or even 20 minutes, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Helen Epstein. She's the author of The Invisible Cure. The subtitle of her book is Africa, the West, and the Fight Against AIDS. Farrar Strasserau is the publisher. She writes frequently on public health for various publications, including the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Magazine. She has a background in molecular biology. Back in the early 90s, she went to Uganda to work on an AIDS vaccine project, and after that continued to work on AIDS as a writer and consultant, and questions are certainly welcome. I'm sure you can find the book if you would like to read it. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Hi. About abstinence-based prevention. Your guest said it doesn't work. And then, right after she said it doesn't work, she referred to the Uganda program, which was uniquely successful in reducing AIDS, and it's basically an abstinence program. That program that doesn't work was uniquely successful in reducing...
Okay, I hear you. But in fact, Uganda's program has been sold as an abstinence program, but it was not an abstinence program. I was actually living in the country when it was being, during the tail end of that program. The program was not an abstinence program. The government of Uganda in the 1980s was very pronatalist. They would not have promoted abstinence because they wanted a high birth rate, essentially. They wanted to populate the country after it had been devastated by civil wars for years. But what they did promote was what was known as zero grazing, which sends a very, very different message. Zero grazing is really addressed to sexually active people who have multiple partners, multiple overlapping relationships. It's not at all about abstinence until marriage. It's addressed to older people, men and women, and the message is not abstain until marriage and be faithful thereafter. It's much more pragmatic than that. It's about reducing your partners and avoiding casual sex because it puts everyone at risk in these sexual networks. It's about avoiding as much as possible having multiple long-term relationships whenever that's practical, and so on. It was not at all an abstain until marriage program, despite what you may have heard from various government, U.S. government sources and so on.
Reducing promiscuity sounds like promoting abstinence. And
it's not. It's very different.
As I understand how the program was represented, it was represented by an expert that I heard as the ABC program. The A stands for abstinence.
It wasn't. ABC was never used in the 1980s and early 90s when the Uganda program was actually in its heyday. ABC was introduced much later, and it was used as a label to kind of describe what Uganda's program's effects were, in the sense that it created changes in all three protective behaviors. But the program was not called ABC at the time. It was labeled ABC by American public health experts working in Washington. It was called zero grazing, and it was very different from ABC.
May I comment? You commented on a sex education and American abstinence-based programs that you say didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are saying that those programs didn't work are sitting right on top of studies that say they do work. Specifically, there was one the state of Virginia made a test of abstinence-based education, determined that it worked beautifully. The education, however, lobby didn't like that study, didn't like the result, so they forgot the study, and they produced their own studies that always determine that abstinence-based sex education doesn't work.
Well, I don't know. There's a website called, I don't know about the Virginia study, so I can't really comment on that, but there's a website called Advocates for Youth, which you may disapprove of, but they publish, as far as I know, some of the best studies conducted by others, including neutral parties and those who support abstinence education, which have shown overwhelmingly that those programs don't work. Now, the Virginia program I don't know, but I do know that Texas evaluated its own abstinence-only programs and found that they didn't work. And this was the government of Texas, which itself supports those programs. So I don't think that there is a conspiracy out there to prove that these programs don't work, but that they have simply been found not to work very well. I mean, one other thing to bear in mind is that just about everywhere in the world where you look, the average age of sexual debut is about 17. In other words, kids in Thailand, Uganda, the United States, Britain, France, everywhere, start to have sex at around 17, 18 years of age. And sex education of any kind has very little effect on that. And certainly abstinence-only education doesn't have much effect on it either.
We're drifting a little bit from our original topic here. I want to get back to that. And particularly, I guess I want to understand and try and make clear to people about the Uganda program, because you've talked about that and the fact that it seemed to have been successful, not so much because it promoted condom use or because it promoted no sex before marriage, but that it sounds as if, and you tell me if this essentially was the message, it sounds as if what the message was to people was something like, for example, if you now have two or three regular long-term sex partners, at the very least, stay with that. Don't just have sex one time with somebody else. Don't add a fourth person, another person. It sounds like it was, at the very least, they were saying, let's have a steady state system here. And I suppose one of the messages might have been, well, if you can reduce the number of sexual partners, that's a fine thing. But it seemed like more important it was, don't increase the number of sexual partners.
I mean, I think the problem is that with these long-term multiple relationships, they tend to be based on very powerful social, economic, and emotional ties. Mm. And it's hard to tell people to just simply be faithful to one partner for life and so on in a situation like that, because the societies are arranged differently, and these kinds of multiple overlapping relationships are really sort of normative and have a strong historical roots. So the abstinence until marriage and perfect faithfulness thereafter message wouldn't have really made sense in a place like Uganda at that time, and it doesn't really make sense elsewhere either. In fact, it doesn't, you know, it's a kind of universal monogamy is an impossible goal anywhere, including the United States. And it's a nice idea, but it's very, very hard to achieve. Some people manage it, and congratulations to them, but it's a tricky message and perhaps a bit unrealistic to expect everyone to do that. But what you can do is to get people to recognize where their risks are coming from. And that's what the Uganda program really conveyed. It wasn't just a slogan of zero grazing. It was really about getting people to talk. And they partly did this just by sending out health educators into villages throughout the region and just sitting down with women's groups, church groups, schools, and stuff. And just telling them, look, this thing is out there. People are dying. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to protect yourself and the people you care about? And they managed. Mm-hmm.
Way back at the beginning, you talked about, I posed this basic question, and it's one of the questions that I know you've thought about that and perhaps starts us into the very book that you wrote. And that question being, well, why is it that given that the this region that we're talking about, this part of East and Southern Africa, while it may have less than 3% of the world's population, has something like 40% of all those affected with HIV. And one of the big factors was that this finding that while people in this region don't have more sexual partners during their lifetime than others, that people, both men and women, are more likely to have more than one long-term partner at a time, and that this is a very good setup for spreading the disease. So here's something that clearly is going on in this particular place that will facilitate the spread, and that might say something about why it is that it's so prevalent. Now, having said all that, having come to this kind of understanding of the way people behave in this one particular place, does that help us at all when you take a look at the rest of the world, particularly other places where there has been a great increase in HIV, and we have a lot of people with HIV, does that help you at all understand what's going on other places, or is this something that's just very specific to this particular region?
Well, this particular pattern of behavior, certainly not unique to Africa, it happens everywhere, but it's much more common there. And so I do think, you know, the message of the dangers of these overlapping relationships needs to be made universal. Everyone needs to know about that. But I think the more, the even more important message is that people everywhere need to know where their risks are coming from, whether it's from injecting drug use, whether it's from homosexual relationships, multiple homosexual relationships, or whether it's from commercial sex work, which are essentially the three modes of transmission most common in other parts of the world. That's the most important thing. And I think the problem in Africa is for too long people haven't been aware of that. In other world regions, what's interesting is that you are actually seeing some declines in HIV infection rates. There was a fear for a long time that, for example, in India, there was going to be an explosive AIDS epidemic on the scale of Africa's. But in fact, the epidemic in India is quite small. Only 0.36% of Indian adults are HIV positive, it's estimated, which is still, for those people, it's a terrible problem, and it's very bad, but it's nothing like on the scale of Africa's epidemic, and it's seems to be improving because people know that if they go to commercial sex workers, they need to use condoms, and they do. And it's much easier to use condoms in those kinds of casual relationships because there's relatively little sense of intimacy and trust and so on. And, you know, people know that sharing needles is risky and so on. So the problem exists. It's still there. But there are straightforward ways to deal with it.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. There's another dimension of this, at least, that I'd like to have you talk about, and that is the kind of attitude or orientation that development groups, people who are interested in putting energy and work and money into working on AIDS in Africa, who come from outside of Africa, from Europe or from the United States, people come with certainly with the best of intentions. But because perhaps they don't understand the context as well as Africans do, that then their efforts might be less than effective. And I suppose you can make the same kind of criticism about all kinds of development projects where people come from outside a society and come in and say, we're here to help. And again, with the best of intentions, say, we're here to help, and here's what we're going to offer you as a solution to all of your problems. And it might not always be the best solution because it's coming from outside, and that it would be a better thing if, in fact, you went to the people that you were going to try to help and said to them, what can we do for you? You tell us what we can do. Well, you know, has the effort to deal with the spread of HIV been hampered because of that orientation, that is, people coming from outside of Africa, not perhaps knowing the culture as well as they should, and coming with their own ideas about what the solution is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's a terribly difficult problem because foreign aid tends to be sort of political and respond more to the politics in the donor countries than in the recipient countries. And, you know, when it comes to AIDS, I think one problem that I found particularly worrying was the way that the situation of orphans and vulnerable children was addressed and so on. I mean, there are something like 11 million children that have lost one or both parents to AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. It's a huge problem because these kids are more likely to drop out of school. They're more likely to contract HIV themselves when they become sexually active. They are often trafficked as housekeepers and maids or sexually abused. Their health is worse and so on. So it's a huge, huge problem. And the U.S. government, through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, made a commitment to help them through various programs. But some of the programs that I visited that were being supported with U.S. funding really, it seemed as though they were supporting these children in extremely superficial ways. And it was very disturbing to see that, because a lot of most, at the moment, African children in this situation are being supported by their communities, by their extended families, and so on, with no help from the outside. And there's so much we could do to help them, and we're really not doing it.
We will try real quick to get in one more caller. We have someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, yeah. One of the reasons I heard that AIDS is so prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa is because it's easier to catch HIV/AIDS when you already have an STD. And we're here, if we get an STD, we go to the doctor and get it taken care of. But there, the medical care isn't as prevalent, so it's just easier to catch HIV there.
Yeah, that was the theory that actually when I first went out to Uganda, that was the sort of prevailing theory as to why HIV was more common in Africa. And since then, there was a great push to kind of improve the treatment services for other sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis and gonorrhea and stuff, to try to improve that situation. The idea was that these sexually transmitted diseases kind of punch holes in the genitalia by creating sores and ulcers that create conduits for the virus to spread through. And the problem is that a large number of clinical trials of these services have been launched. And for whatever reason, the theory hasn't really quite panned out as people expected it to. In other words, improving services for sexually transmitted diseases treatment has not reduced HIV infection rates. There have been four or five attempts to do that in different African countries where the services were improved and people were encouraged to go and get their STDs treated and healed and so on. And it didn't make any difference. The HIV continued to spread just as rapidly as it had before the services were improved. So, although in one case there was an improvement, actually, but in four other cases it didn't seem to make any difference. And if you look at a country like Botswana, where health services are relatively good and people can get their STDs treated promptly, you have staggeringly high HIV rates. So it's really not clear what the connection is. I mean, I think the STDs are a problem, but improving the services doesn't seem to make that much difference. And so that also, the kind of mixed results with those programs also led people to rethink the theory about the importance of STDs and HIV transmission. I hope that helps explain.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just real quick, earlier in the program, you talked about the fact that if you ask this question, why is the rate of HIV so high in East and Southern Africa? One is the pattern of sexual relations that we've talked about. The other, you said, is the lack of male circumcision. Mm. And in fact, in the book, you write that to date, the closest thing to a vaccine to prevent HIV is male circumcision, which has been shown to be here in the book. It says in 2006 was shown to reduce the risk of HIV transmission by roughly 50%. So you'd think, you know, there wouldn't be anything else that would be such a relatively easy, straightforward, not terribly complicated, not expensive thing that you could do. This would be it. At the same time, I'm sure that this may indeed be a hard sell. You know, anytime you're trying to convince a guy to do something to his penis, now, you know, that's going to be, you're going to have some resistance. How successful has this been as
actually, as
preventive?
It's surprising. There's actually a lot of demand for these services now because people are really worried about it. And I think it's quite important. There's a lot of debate about it in public health circles and concern about it for some of the reasons you raise. But in Africa itself, there's great demand for them, and a lot of men want these services and want to be circumcised now. But the services are not available. So I think it's imperative that the international public health community scale up these services as rapidly as possible so that all men who want to be circumcised can be as quickly as possible. The problem is that some men won't want to be circumcised, obviously. Not everyone wants to undergo this procedure. It's no fun. You know, even if every man were circumcised tomorrow, the HIV rates would still, HIV would continue to spread because it's not, doesn't offer total protection. So that's a kind of behavior change still has to be there somewhere in the equation.
Well, we're going to have to stop at this point simply because we've come to the end of the time. Much more in the book if you'd like to read it. It's titled The Invisible Cure, Africa, the West, and the Fight Against AIDS by our guest Helena Epstein, the book published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Ms. Epstein, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Support for our program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the evolution of public life in America as Iowans prepare to caucus. Celeste Quinn will be talking with historian Morton Keller about his new book, America's Three Regimes, A New Political History. He's a professor of history emeritus at Brandeis University, and he will be joining Celeste in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. The program itself gets underway at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580 right here on AM 580. Coming up in the next part of the show, we will be talking about Tai Chi and Qigong, things that have been practiced in China for many thousands of years, in large part because people felt that there were real health benefits to these practices. Now, in recent years, growing numbers of Americans have taken them up and have indeed discovered, they would say, that these traditional forms can bring a number of benefits. We'll be talking with a man who has been a lifelong practitioner of Tai Chi and Qigong, who's also done research on the health benefits. His name is Yang Yang. He's an adjunct professor of kinesiology here at the University of Illinois. He'll be joining us in the next part of the show, so we hope that you can stick around. Right now, we will take a break, as we usually do at this time, for an update on the news and the markets. Then we'll be back, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson's team of experts and strategic consulting approach utilize the latest technology. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at midday. Grain futures are up all across the complex floor at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City. Let's go ahead and get you right to the particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat now trading at 965, up 29. The July at 844, up 16.5. At the Board of Trade, March wheat at 940, up 25. Has been as high as 945, so it did lock limit up at one point today. The May at 948.5, up 26. July 807, up 16.25. March corn at 464, up 1.5. May 475, up 1.5. July 484, up 1. December 484.25, up 4. January beans 1245.5, up 13.